finally, the sixth thing in this patriarchal period that he wants to teach us is in verse 22. By faith, Joseph. Now, even Joseph, the one who had pushed his two sons up there, when he was dying, isn't it interesting? More time is spent in the book of Genesis on Joseph than anybody else. And when it comes down to it, and we read Hebrews 11, where we have one little event, and we want to say, why didn't you talk about all these other things in Joseph's life? How about the coat of many pieces? How about the kidnapping? How about the slavery? How about Potiphar's wife? How about the years in prison? How about his leadership in Egypt? How about the wonderful forgiveness he exhibited in sparing his brothers and providing for them? All that is passed over. And we have one little event in Joseph's life at the very end of his life when he's 110 years old in the year 1805 B.C. And all it says is this, and Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. That's prophecy. Why? Why is that faith? Because it was a promise that his father told him about, and he believed the promise that his father told him, and by believing the promise, he exercised faith, not by looking at the surroundings and saying, there's no way we can ever leave this place, but by believing the promise, he prophesied about the Exodus, because he said, God said it was going to happen. My father told me. And this is what I want you to do. Someday you're going to leave this place. And when you go, take my bones with you. And the author of Hebrews says that's faith, because he believed a promise that seemed impossible. And that's faith. Well, this opens up our third division, and the third division is the life of Moses, and gives us the history from the birth of Moses right down to the defeat at Jericho. And, of course, that goes from verse 23 right down through verse 30, 31 with the life of Rahab. Now, I don't have time to deal with all of these, but let me just draw your attention to what's mentioned here. First of all, verse 23, Moses, by faith, it says, when he was born, was hidden. Whose faith was that? It was not Moses' faith. That was the faith of Moses' parents. Okay? So Moses' parents had faith, and they hid him in opposition to the Pharaoh's law and decree that male children should be killed. By faith, they hid him. And you're familiar with that story. That's the first thing he wants to draw our attention to. Then in verse 24, by faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. That was an exercise of faith. He rejected his rich and powerful environment, and by faith stepped out, not knowing what the next day would bring. That's faith, he said. The third thing he wants us to see is verse 27. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, because he saw him who is unseen. So even though he was afraid the king would follow him, afraid the king would come after him, he still left his past behind when chances are he could have been the next Pharaoh of Egypt. He turned his back on that and stepped out by faith. The next thing he wants us to see in verse 28, by faith he kept the Passover. Well, what's that got to do with faith? Simply the fact that God promised him that if you put blood on the doorposts and the lintel, the death angel will pass over you. Now, that's faith. And on top of that, what did he have to do? He had to go to all the Israelites in Egypt and pass the word along. And do you realize how his word was on the line? How would you like to say something like that? Okay, folks, get ready, because tonight the firstborn in all of Egypt will be killed. And the only way to prevent anyone in our households from being killed is to take that lamb, slaughter it, spread some blood on the doorpost and the lintel. You can put the blood down the basin, that little worn-out threshold. Pour it in there, get your little swab and swab it around. People are to say, what does that have to do with anything else? So Moses' life and testimony were on the line when he said that. But guess what happened? It happened. But he said it took faith for Moses to say that. to believe the promise of God that something would happen that had never happened before. And as the screams of the dying were spreading throughout Egypt, and the people inside the houses with the blood on the doorposts were safe and secure, then that faith that Moses exhibited was verified. He said, that's faith, to speak out like that because God says something. Well, the next couple of things he wants us to see are down here, verse 29. Let's just look at that very quickly. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea. Well, what took so much faith in that? Well, if you were to go back to the narrative, you would see that they ended up at a dead end. And there's an interesting little thing that takes place here at that Red Sea experience. Go back, if you will, to Exodus 12. I'm going to show you something very quickly. Exodus 12, 7. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the houses which they eat. He gives them the specific instructions, and he says, that's faith. Now going over to chapter 14. After this exercise of faith, after the Passover, the Egyptians let them go. Now I go over to 14:14. They're up here against this dead end. The people are asking to go back. And Moses says to them in verse 14, the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. But you see, something happened between verse 14 and verse 15 that's not said to us here. Read verse 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, when? I don't know when. What happened? Why are you crying out to me? Do we have any record of him crying out to God? No. What did Moses do? How was this Red Sea experience faith? Because he turned to the people and he said, God's going to fight for you. That was a statement he made. And then what did he do? He turned and started crying to God and said, okay, God, fight for us now. You see, that's what happened. Because then the next word in 15 says, then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Go ahead. That's the faith. Is that before God ever said anything to him, he spoke on God's behalf and told the people God was going to fight. Then he turned and said, okay, anytime. God said, go ahead. He said, that's faith. So that's the aspect of the Red Sea experience that the author of Hebrews wants us to see as faith. Believing that God will deliver even when the odds are against us. Having that kind of faith and assurance about what God is going to do. What's the next thing he wants us to see? Well, let's go down. After the Red Sea experience, he says, verse 30, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down. Well, 40 more years go by between the Red Sea experience and the Jericho experience. How did faith have anything to do with the walls falling down? Well, faith had to do, again, by Joshua saying, you know, after the crossing of the Jordan when it dried up, all of these Hebrew soldiers were there just itching for battle. What did they want to do? They wanted to physically attack the walls of Jericho and tear them down brick by brick. What does Joshua say? No, no, that doesn't work this time. God has a spiritual lesson to teach us. Therefore, we start walking. And they walked around one time the first day. And they walked around one time the second day. And they walked around one time the third day. Where does the faith come in? To keep walking. What takes faith about that? What do you think the inhabitants who dwelt on the walls of Jericho were doing about the third day? They were laughing, probably throwing stuff down at them. You know, you'd be there with a banana peel on your helmet. Walking around and you've got your spear in your hand. Oh, let me at them. Joshua would say, no, don't even say anything. You can't talk. Just walk. The sixth day, they walk again. By that time, they're throwing cabbages and everything and laughing, you know. But then finally, they kept walking and walking. And on the seventh day, he said, this time, we're going to walk seven times. If we get around seven times, we're all going to shout. And we all shout, the walls are going to fall. You see, that's faith. The faith that Joshua had to believe that God was going to do something that had never been done before. No one had ever been taken to heaven before. Enoch was. Okay? No one had ever seen rain before. Noah built an ark. Walls had never fallen flat before. Joshua said, keep walking. No one ever parted the Red Sea before. Moses said, keep going. First person had ever been slain before. The eldest had never been slain before. Moses said, put the blood around the doorpost. You see, so what we have here in Hebrews 11 is an ongoing series of examples about how people believed God to do something that had never been done before, to believe His promises, and to step out in faith and apprehend them. That's what Hebrews 11 is all about. What's the next thing He wants us to see here? Well, He wants us to see also that in this whole Jericho experience, verse 31, by faith Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. You recall the story in Joshua, and we won't go through that now, but the one thing that was said to Rahab was, if you want what we have promised to come true, you must hang a scarlet thread from your window. Did Rahab wait a few days until she saw the invading army? No. When you read that narrative, you'll see that immediately Rahab ran and dropped the scarlet thread. And I want you to study that section, and you'll see the salvation experience. She hears, she asks, she obeys immediately. And now as the walls of Jericho are crumbling, as fires are breaking out, as people are screaming, as the soldiers are running across the debris and the fallen bricks, what are they doing? They're running for Rahab's house. And Rahab is there in the middle of the chaos, waiting for these men to rescue her. How was that faith? Because as the walls were falling, as people were fleeing, as people were being slaughtered and they were screaming, Rahab was waiting. Waiting for these men to rescue her, as she had said they would do, because she did what they said to do by hanging the scarlet thread out the window. And it says, by faith, Rahab did not perish with those who were first disobedient. And now my problem is the same problem that the author of Hebrews had in verse 32. And what shall I say? For time will fail me. Look at those individuals yourselves, and you'll see in their lives unusual examples of what God wants us to see in regard to how to apprehend these things. Well, what did all of these do? Verses 33 and 34, they all were conquerors because they were living the faith life. In verse 35, as you read that, you'll see as the author refers to some of these cases where they were tortured, that some recanted and some didn't. Some denied their testimony and some didn't. In verse 39, these individuals never got the promise. What promise? The promise that has been expected and anticipated throughout the entire book. Faith rest. God's rest. Well, they didn't get that on the earth, but they did get it, and they've got it now. God's promised rest, and it'll be fulfilled in the millennium when that time that the author's speaking of comes to pass. That perfection that will come. God's rest that will come. He says in verse 40 that because of Christ and because of the fact that He loved the church and gave Himself for it, and because of the fact that the church of God has a unique part of God's overall plan, these Old Testament saints are blessed because of us. Because of us, because of the fact that Christ died, the paradise side of Hades is empty. If we're not for the church, if we're not for the sacrifice, burial, resurrection of Christ, if it was not for the fact that He led captivity captive, those Old Testament saints would still be in the paradise side of Hades. He said, because of us, they have the promise of perfection. Look what He says in verse 40, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they, the Old Testament saints, should not be made perfect. That perfection, which only comes in the death, burial, resurrection of Christ, and what His present work and activity as high priest does for us, and the perfection that they have attained because of His love for us as members of the body of Christ, that He loved us and gave Himself for us. He taught us something for the last 10 chapters, and now when He got into chapter 11, He shows us in chapter 11 how through this Old Testament period, all of these individuals whose names are legend in the Old Testament, and whose names were very familiar to his first century A.D. reader, how all of these individuals, the Old Testament heroes and heroine of the faith that we would say, the Christian Hall of Fame, those people using what he's been teaching about faith, made these things work in their lives. And now he swings from the chapter 11 application, which the Old Testament individuals put into effect, and now swings over, and in chapter 12, he's going to show us how to apply these things of which he's been speaking. So it's kind of a teaching, Old Testament example. Now he addresses primarily his first century AD audience, but we can apply those principles to our own lives as well in regard to how these people lived their lives and how these people were successful, because everyone wants to be successful. Being successful in the world's eyes is not the same as being successful in God's eyes. Being successful in God's eyes is how we take what God has to say in his word and have not just a head knowledge, but we have a heart knowledge. And we can take what he says in his word, understand it, then apply it. These principles in God's word are meaningless as long as they don't go from here down to here. We can have all the knowledge that anyone can have, but until we begin to work out what God says about love, about understanding, about compassion, about relationships, and when we begin to live our lives and see our structure of life and see how our involvement in relationships is one in which Christ would have us emulate what he would do, then and only then do we become successful in life. So wherever we find ourselves, we must say to ourselves, what would Christ do in this situation? How would he react to this person? How would he love this person? How would he understand this person? You see, because he wants to live his life through us. And that's what relationships are all about, and that's how one lives a life successfully. So he points back to these Old Testament people, and he says, look at these Old Testament people, and look what they did. They faced a variety of hardships, yet they were successful. They left riches behind in many cases. They stepped out on faith, not knowing where they were going. They worked marvelous miracles. Why, they walked with God. And all these things were accomplished, he says, through faith, by apprehending and by appropriating these promises of God, by seeing invisible things as though they were visible. He says, that's how you live. And now he goes on into chapter 12, and you notice that he begins chapter 12 with our old favorite word, therefore. And again, what's the therefore? Therefore, it's therefore because of what he said in chapter 11. Therefore, and we can almost drop out one section of verse 1 if we could make it a little more easy to understand. We could say, therefore, and then jump right down to let us. Therefore, let us do four things. But before he says, let us do, thus and so, he puts another little section in there and refers back to this cloud of witnesses in chapter 11. And he says it this way, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us, and let us also. When he says let us also, we must assume that whatever he is going to ask us to do, these others who have gone before did it also. Therefore, let us also. But we're going to do it because we can look back on these who have gone before, who experienced the same kinds of things that we experience, and we can have victory and success just as they did because we have the same promises and the same source of faith as they did, and we can look back at them. Now, this word cloud that it's used here is not the normal word cloud in Scripture in Greek, nephele, which means a little clear, distinct, crisply outlined cloud against the horizon. It's the Greek word nephos, which means a mass of cloud covering all of the sky. This terminology was a familiar Greek literary term anyway, because Homer, for example, speaks of a cloud of footmen. They speak of the Trojans as a cloud of Trojan warriors, and there were so many of them, they would just cover the entire sky, and he uses this Greek terminology and refers to these Old Testament people that he described in chapter 11 as a cloud, so many of whom, and so much cloud that it would absolutely block out the horizon and block out the heavens. And he says, these people, these Old Testament people, this cloud, they were witnesses. And by that term, he means that they had observed something, they had gone through something, they had experienced something to which they can bear witness. So what he does, in effect, is to look back in the Old Testament to chapter 11, and he says, I'm going to look back, and I have called these people in chapter 11 to the witness stand. And what they are going to bear witness to when they come to the witness stand is this faith by which they appropriated God's promises, which enabled them to live a life which was successful. When you go through the different commentaries about chapter 11 in Hebrews, you'll find that a lot of the commentators will say, these Old Testament people are still up there now, looking down on us and watching everything that's going on. Well, that's a possibility. I don't particularly hold to that position, but many of the commentators that you will read do believe that. I think what he's done here is use chapter 11 simply as an illustration of this idea that he has about the fact that life, and the Christian life in particular, is a race. And what he does with this illustration in chapter 11 and chapter 12, verse 1, is to show us several important things in this concept that he has for us. He says, first of all, assuming the Christian life is some kind of contest, some kind of event, not that we are contestants against one another, but that we are contestants in a contest all going toward the same goal. He said, first of all, what we want to understand is that this stadium in which we are competing is full of people. And in a way, the author is saying that. He says, you're in a game, a contest, a sports event. And it's almost as if the stadium is full of people. But they aren't just nondescript people. They are people, he would have us know, who have run the same kind of race that you are running. They are not people who cannot sympathize with the race you're in because they have done it. And because they have done it, they can look on you as you run and be either critical, or they can find your shortcomings as you're running, or they can be supportive, but most of all, they can understand. And then he wants us to see, by saying this, that also they've done it, and the reason to run is because we have those around us who have done it. And because of this, it's almost as if we're in the stadium looking at all these people around, and we're ready to run this race of life, the Christian life in particular. And as we do, he says, when you run the race, as you're preparing to run the race, you must do four things. And here are the things that you must do as we get ready to run this race. Now remember, this is not a physical race. This race that you're running does not depend on your physical ability. It depends on your spiritual ability. This is a spiritual race. He says, as you get ready to run the spiritual race, here's what you must do. First of all, let us also, these others have done it, by the way, lay aside every encumbrance. It's the Greek word agkon. And what that means is a mass of flesh. Let us lay aside that useless mass of flesh. That's what the Greek word means, because he's referring to this athletic contest. He said, and he's saying in effect, even innocent things, and additional flesh is an innocent thing. He said, that's an innocent thing, but if you're going to be in a race, sometimes even the innocent things must be removed before you can compete successfully. And the inference here is that of an athlete who, prior to the contest, some weeks or months in advance, begins to trim down and get rid of those things that ordinarily are not encumbrances, but are an encumbrance when he begins to get involved in the contest. Many of us are still at the starting line and have never seen the finish line when it comes to the spiritual contest. And excess weight doesn't mean anything until you begin to exercise, and you notice you have excess weight. That's what he's saying here. We're to lay aside this excess baggage that sometimes we involve ourselves with, which until we're in the Christian race, we don't really know it's excess baggage. Secondly, he goes on and he says, in addition to that, lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. This word entangles us is a word which means to wrap itself around like a cloak. Now, what would you think if you went to a race and looked out at the starting line and saw one of the distance runners in a long gown with long sleeves on it, ready to run the race? You would say, hey, take that gown off. You can't run this race with that gown on. Why, the sleeves and everything, it'll get tangled up and you'll trip and fall, and that's what the Greek word means. There is something in your life, possibly, which when you begin to be involved in the Christian race, is going to tangle around you and trip you up as a long garment would if you were in a physical race. And we're to put that aside as well. We're to be out there, as it were, stripped and ready for battle, having nothing around us that's going to entangle us. And he goes on to say, and run with endurance, and that word endurance means active persistence. Regardless of the obstacles that may come along, we are to be actively persistent in this race after we are spiritually fit for the contest. And finally, we are to run the race, and there is a race. He uses an unusual word here for race. It's not the Greek word usually used for race, which is dramos, but he uses the word agon, which means contest. So it's not that this is necessarily a race, a foot race, but it is a contest, which he says is set before us, which means stretching out before our eyes. So we're to lay aside this encumbrance, the excess baggage, even innocent things, and that sin, which in our case can entangle us, and which in the case of the first century AD professing Jewish reader was that intent to turn back to the Old Testament. And we're to run with active persistence in this contest. And I think it's good that he uses that word, because God determines for each of us the kind of contest that we are going to be in. For some, it may be a short sprint. For some, it may be a marathon run. For some, it may be a steeplechase. You may be hitting water holes and branches and stumps and trenches in this contest that you're in. You may be in the high hurdles. But each of us has a different kind of contest that we are to run. But the idea is that throughout this contest, as verse 2 says, we are to fix our eyes on Jesus. So we don't look back at the starting line. We don't look around at the other contestants. We don't look into the grandstands at the spectators, even though we know they're there. The idea in this contest is fixing, which means to turn your eyes from everything else towards something. And we're to fix our eyes intently on Jesus, who is the author or chief leader of our faith. Because what he says by this is, that Jesus is the one whose faith far surpasses the faith of all those talked about in chapter 11.
This concludes number 11.